In the house there was sudden commotion. The boy had disappeared, the heir to the estates, the young Prince Ling. Where was he now? He was not in his bed. There was panic. The mother thought he must have run away, being frightened by the severity of his father. The father thought he must have run away, being frightened by the anger of mother, for that day nothing that the poor boy did was right. He had been in trouble the day long, first for getting then for tearing his clothes, then for not being where should have been at a certain time, then for not being present punctually for meals. Everything was wrong for him. Servants were roused, the grounds were searched, butter lamps flared, and flint and tinder smoked. A procession of servants went around the gardens calling for the young master, but without avail, he wasn't to be found. Sister Yasodhara was awakened to ask her if she could account for the movements of her brother, but no, she wiped her bleary eyes with the back of her hand, lay down again and was asleep while she was still sitting. Servants hurried down the road in the darkness to see if the boy had gone away. Other servants searched the house from top to bottom, and eventually in a storeroom Lobsang was found, asleep on a bag of grain with a cat at each side of him, and all three were snoring mightily. But not for long. The father rushed forward with a roar of rage which almost seemed to shatter the walls. Certainly it made the dust from the grain bags jump and dance in the air. The lamps carried by servants flickered, and one or two went out. The poor boy was grasped tightly by the neck while one mighty hand lifted him up high. The mother rushed forward expostulating, "Stop, stop. Be very sure you don't mark him, because tomorrow he will be the cynosure of all the eyes of Lhasa. Just send him to bed." So the poor boy was given a hearty thump and pushed forward so violently that he fell on his face. One of the men servants picked him up and carried him away. Of the cats there was no sign. But in the great Potala, at the level assigned to the astrologers, the activity still continued. The chief astrologer was carefully checking his figures, carefully checking his charts, rehearsing what he was going to say, practicing the intonation which he would find necessary. Around him Lama astrologers took each sheet of paper and with two other Lamas checking every sheet was placed in its correct order. There could be no possibility of error here, no possibility of reading from the wrong page and bringing the College of Astrologers into disrepute. As each book was completed, its wooden cover was placed on top and the book was held together with twice the customary number of tapes, just so that everything would be doubly sure. The monk assigned to be the personal attendant of the chief astrologer was carefully brushing his best robe, making sure that the zodiacal signs with which it was embellished were bright and fixed on securely. Then, as he was an old man, he used two sticks, and those two sticks were carefully examined for any unsuspected flaws or cracks, after which they were passed to a polishing monk who polished them until they shone like burnished copper. From the temple areas the gongs boomed, the trumpets blared, and there was a susurration of scurrying feet as the religious monks went about their first night service. The astrological monks had been excused attendance because of the importance of the task allotted to them, because they could not risk dropping everything to go to service and then finding on the morrow that some error had crept in. So at last the butter lamps were extinguished one by one. Soon there was no light except the light of the heaven, the starlight and the moonlight. But the starlight and the moonlight were augmented by the brilliant reflections from the lakes and rivers which traversed and crisscrossed the plain of Lhasa. Every so often a dazzling sheet of water would cascade in a burst of glittering silver, like molten silver, as some great fish rushed up to the surface for a gulp of air. All was silent except for the croaking of bullfrogs and the cries of night birds in the distance. The moon sailed in solitary splendor across the purple sky. The light of the dimmed as clouds from India obscured their glimmer. Night was upon the land, and all those except the creatures of the night slept. Chapter 3. The first faint light appeared over the jagged eastern horizon. Great mountain ranges stood up in the starkest black, and behind them the sky was becoming luminous. On the topmost floor of the Lamasery's monks and lamas stood ready to greet the new day. The topmost floor, the roof, in each case had a special platform or parapet on which great conches and trumpets some 15 to 20 feet long stood on stands. The valley of Lhasa was a pool of inky black. The moon had long since set, and the stars were diminished by the paling of the sky beyond the eastern mountains. But the valley of Lhasa still slept, still lived in the deepest darkness of night. Not until the sun lifted well above the mountains would the deep-lying lamaseries and houses welcome daylight. Here and there dotted randomly throughout the valley infrequent pinpoints of light appeared as a lama or kokora herdsman had to prepare for a very early start to his work. The faint, faint gleam served merely to accentuate the velvet blackness, so black that not even the trunk of tree could be distinguished. The light beyond the eastern mountains increased. First there was a vivid flash of light, and then a red beam shot up, followed immediately by what appeared to be an absolutely green shaft of light, which was one of the features of the early morning sunrise and the late night sunset. Soon there came broader shafts of light, and within minutes there was a startling golden glow outlining the high peaks, showing the ever-present snow reflecting off high glaciers and projecting down into the valley the first signs that the day had appeared. With the first appearance of the sun over the topmost edge of the mountains, the lamas blew hard into their trumpets, and others sounded into the conches so that the very air seemed to shake with the sound. There was no immediate reaction to the noise, though, for the people of the valley were well used to the sound of trumpets and conches and could ignore it just as people in cities can ignore the roaring of aircraft, the clattering of garbage collections, and all the rest of the noises of civilization. Here and there, though, a sleepy nightbird uttered a startled chirp before putting his head beneath his wing again and going off to sleep. Now was the time of the creatures of the day. Gradually the day birds came awake, cheeping sleepily and then flapping their wings to get rid of the stillness of the night. Here and there a feather drifted down and was blown at the whim of the vagrant breeze. In the waters of the Kaichu and at the snake temple, fish were stirring lazily from their nighttime drifting near the surface. Fish in Tibet could always rise near the surface because Buddhists do not take life, and there were no fishermen in Tibet. The old man twisted at the sound of the bugles and the roaring of the conches, twisted and sleepily sat upright. From his low angle he peered upwards at the sky, and then a sudden thought struck him and he rose creakily to his feet. His bones were aged, his muscles tired, so he rose with circumspection and made his way to a window and looked out across the now awakening city of Lhasa. Below him in the village of Sho, little lights were beginning to appear, one after another, as butter lamps were being lit so that officials who were going to be busy this day would have ample time for their preparations. The aged astrologer shivered in the early dawn chill, and pulled his robe more tightly around him. Inevitably thoughts turned to the Lhalu estate, which could not be seen from his vantage point, for he looked out over the village of Sho and the city of Lhasa, and the Lhalu residence was at the other side of the Potala, facing the wall with the carved figures which was so much an attraction for wandering pilgrims. The old man slowly lowered himself again to his blankets, and rested while he thought of the events of the day. This day, he thought, would be one of the high points of his career. Perhaps the culminating point of his career. Already the old man could feel the hand of approaching death upon him. He could feel the slowing down of his body processes. He could feel that already his silver cord was thinning. But he was glad that there was yet one more function he could perform and bring credit to: the office of chief astrologer of Tibet. So thinking, he dozed off, to be awakened with something of a start as a lama bustled into the room exclaiming, "Honorable astrologer, the day is upon us, we have no time to lose, we have again to check the horoscope and the order in which the points are to be presented. I will assist you to rise, honorable astrologer." So saying, he bent down and put an arm around the shoulders of the old man and gently raised him to his feet. By now the sun was increasing rapidly, the sun was clear of the eastern mountain range and was reflecting light to the western side of the valley, while those houses and lamaseries right beneath the eastern range were yet in darkness, those on the opposite side were in almost full daylight. The Potala was coming awake. There was the strange stir which humans always make when they are getting themselves into motion at the beginning of a day. There was a feeling of awareness that here were humans ready to continue the sometimes tedious business of living. Little silver bells were tinkling. Every so often there would come the lowing of a conch or perhaps the brassy blare of a trumpet. The old astrologer and the others around him were not aware of the clanking and turning of the prayer wheels. These were so much a part of their everyday existence that they had long since failed to perceive the noise the prayer wheels made, just as no longer did they notice the prayer flags which whipped to the morning breeze on the Potala Heights above. Only a cessation of these noises would have been noticed by the startled people. There was the scurry of feet along corridors, there was the moving of heavy doors. From somewhere came the chanting of psalm, religious psalm, psalms again welcoming the new day. But the old astrologer had no time to notice things such as these, for now there was the business of coming to full awareness and to attending to those functions which are so necessary after a night of sleep. Soon he would be having his morning meal of tsampa and tea, and then he would have to go and attend to the ritual of preparing for the reading which he was that day to give. At the Lalu family residence the servants were awake. Lady Rampa, too, was awake. And Lord Rampa, after a hasty breakfast, gladly mounted his horse and rode off with his attendants to the offices of the government in the village of Sho. He was indeed glad to get away from his wife, get away from her bustling officiousness and her overzealous approach to the events facing them. He had to make an early start to his work because later in the day it would be utterly incumbent upon him to return to play the part of the gracious host who was a prince of Lhasa. The heir to the Rampa estates was awakened and came to life most reluctantly. Today was his day, yet, he thought with some confusion, how could it be his day when mother was planning to make such a social advantage from it? If he had his way he would forget the idea and disappear to the banks of the river so that he could watch the boatmen ferrying people across the river, and perhaps when there were not many people to be ferried he could manage to con the ferryman into giving him free passage backwards and forwards, always with the excuse, of course, that he would help pull the ferry. The poor wretched boy was most unhappy at the hard-hearted manservant who was thoroughly smearing his eye one with yak butter, and then plaiting a tight pigtail with curious twist in it. The yak butter was kneaded into the pigtail until the latter was almost as still as a willow rod. At about 10 in the morning there was the sound and clatter of horses and a party of men rode into the courtyard. The Lord Rampa and his attendants had returned from the government offices because it was necessary that the family should go to the Cathedral of Lhasa to give thanks for whatever mysteries were to be revealed on this day and, of course, to show to priests ever ready to believe that blackheads were irreligious that these were specially religious blackheads. In Tibet monks have shaven heads, while the ordinary people, the laity, had long hair, most times it was black hair, and because of the black hair they were referred to as blackheads. People were waiting in the courtyard, Lady Rampa already upon a pony, and her daughter Yasodhara. At the last moment the heir of the family was grabbed and unceremoniously hoisted upon a pony that appeared equally reluctant. The gates were again opened and the party rode out with the Lord Rampa at the head. For about 30 minutes they rode in strange silence until at last they came to the small houses and the shops which surrounded the Cathedral of Lhasa, the cathedral which had stood there for so many hundreds of years to afford a place of worship for the pious. The original stone floors were deeply grooved and scored by the footsteps of pilgrims and sightseers. All along the entrance to the cathedral were lines of prayer wheels, big things indeed, and as each person went by they turned the wheel as was the custom so that a most curious tinkling clatter was set up which had an almost hypnotic effect. The inside of the cathedral was heavy, overpowering in its heaviness with the scent of incense and the memory of incense which had been burned during the past 1300 or 1400 years. The heavy black beams of the roof seemed to have clouds of incense growing from them, bluish smoke, grey smoke, and occasionally a smoke of a brownish hue. There were various gods and goddesses represented in golden figures, wooden figures, and porcelain figures, and before each were the offerings of pilgrims. Every so often the offerings would be swept behind a metal net to protect them from pilgrims whose piety was overcome by the desire to participate in the wealth of the gods. Heavy candles burned and made flickering shadows throughout the dim building. It was a sobering thought even to a small boy not yet 7 years of age to reflect that these candles had been kept alight by pouring on butter throughout 1300 or 1400 years. The poor boy gazing wide-eyed around him thought, "Let's get this day over and perhaps I shall be able to go to some other country, away from all this holiness. Little did he know what was in store for him. A big cat strolled lethargically forward and rubbed against the legs of the heir of the Ramper family. The boy stooped and dropped to his knees to fondle the big cat, who roared with delight. These were the guardian cats of the temple, astute students of human nature who could tell at a glance those who would be likely to attempt to steal and those who could be trusted. Normally such cats would never, never approach anyone other than their own particular keeper. For a moment there was stunned silence among the onlookers, and some of the monks faltered in their chanting as their eyes wandered to the sight of the boy on his knees by the big cat. The picture was soon spoiled, however, because the Lord Ramper, his face suffused with rage, bent down and picked up the boy by the scruff of his neck, shook him like a housewife shaking out a duster, gave him a slap on the ear which made the boy think there was a thunderstorm, and then dumped him on his feet again. The cat turned towards his lordship and uttered a very long, loud hiss, and then turned with dignity and strode away. But the time had come to return to the Lalula residence, for soon the guests would start arriving. Many of the guests came early so that they could get the pick of what was offered, and the pick of what was offered included the best place in the garden. So the party left the confines of the cathedral and went out into the street again. The boy raised his eyes and saw the flags fluttering over the road which led to India, and he thought, "Shall I soon be on that road going to another count? I shall soon know, I suppose, but, my goodness, I would like something to eat." The party rode on, retracing their footsteps, and after 25 to 30 minutes they were again entering the courtyard of the house, where they were greeted by an anxious steward who thought that there might have been some delay and that he would have to explain to irate guests that the host and hostess had been unaccountably delayed at the cathedral. There was time for a hurried meal, and then the heir to the estates rushed to the window at unexpected noises approaching up the road. Monk musicians were arriving. Their musical instruments were clattering as they rode along the road on their ponies. Every so often a monk would give an experimental blow to his trumpet or clarinet to make sure that it was in tune. Now and again a monk would give a hearty bonk to a drum to make sure that the skin was at the correct tautness. Eventually they entered the courtyard and went by the side path into the gardens, carefully depositing their instruments on the ground. The instruments deposited, they reached for the Tibetan beer gladly. The beer was there in some profusion to prepare them, to get them in the right mood to make jovial music instead of somber classical stuff. But there was no time to deal with the musicians. The first of the guests were arriving. They came in a body. It seemed as if all Asa was moving on to the Lalula residence. Here came a small army of men on horseback, all heavily armed. It was something like the invading army sent by the British, but this army was armed only because ceremony and protocol demanded it. They rode with men on the outside, and between the lines of men the women rode, where they were adequately protected from any imaginary attack. The armed servitors had their spears and pikes gaily decorated with flags and with pennants. Here and there, as a monk was in the party, prayer flags fluttered from a staff. In the courtyard itself there were two lines of servants, headed by the steward on one side and the chief household priest on the other. There was much ado with bowing, returning bows, and bowing again as the guests were ushered in. Each guest was helped off his horse as if, as the heir to the household thought, they were all a lot of paralyzed dummies. Their horses were led away and given ample food. Then, depending upon the status of the guests, they were either shown into the garden and left to fend for themselves, or shown into the house where they would exclaim over this or that article, articles which had been put out especially to impress the guests. Of course, in Tibet, scarves are given and received, and there was much confusion as the arriving guests presented scarves and then received scarves in return. Sometimes there was a most awkward incident when some bemused servant would unthinkingly hand back to the guest the scarf which he or she had just presented. There would be embarrassed smiles and muttered apologies, but soon the matter would be straightened out. Lady Ramper was red of face and perspiring freely. She was terrified that the old astrologer, the chief astrologer of all Tibet, must have died, or fallen into the river, or been trampled upon by a horse, or some similar mishap, because there was no sign of him, and the purpose of the whole party was to have the reading of the future for the heir to the household. Without the chief astrologer, that could not be done. A servant was dispatched at the run to ascend to the highest point one end the house and to look out toward Potala, to see if there was any sign of the approaching cavalcade which would herald the impending arrival of the astrologer. The servant departed and soon was seen o'er the topmost roof. He was gesticulating with his arms, and dancing little jig in his excitement. Lady Rampa was furious, absolutely frustrated. She had no idea what the servant was trying to convey. It looked as if he were drunk more than anything else. So hastily she sent a fresh servant to get a report as to what was happening. Soon the two servants arrived together and explained that the astrological cavalcade was just crossing the plain of Kaichu. That was the signal for increased fervor. Lady Rampa ushered everyone out of the house and into the garden, telling them to take their places because the great chief astrologer was arriving any moment. The monk musicians straightened up and started to play, making the air shake and vibrate with the excitement that they put into the event. The Lualu estate gardens were large and very well kept. There were trees from all over Tibet, even some from India, from Bhutan and Sikkim. Bushes, too, grew in great profusion with exotic blooms entrancing the eye. But now the wonderful showpiece of a garden was thronged with avid sightseers, people who had no thought for horticulture, people who were there for sensation. The great Lord Rampa wandered disconsolately about, chewing on his knuckles with an agony of anguished frustration and at the same time trying to smile amiably at those people whom he felt he should beam upon. Lady Rampa was almost wearing herself shorter by the amount of running about she was doing. She was in a continual bustle, trying to see the Lord Rampa wasn't too austere, trying to see what the heir to the estate was doing, what the servants were doing, and keeping a ready eye for the arrival of the chief astrologer. There came the sound of horses' steps. The steward hurried to the main gate, which was carefully shut behind him. He stood ready to order its opening at just the right moment to make the maximum effect. Guests had heard the horses and were now streaming from the garden into a very large room which, for the occasion, had been converted into a refectory reception room. Here they found butter tea waiting for them and, of course, delicacies from India, very sweet sticky cakes which would effectively glue them up and prevent them from talking so much. There came the sound of a deep-toned gong, its voice echoing and reverberating around the building, a mighty gong some 5 feet high and which was only used on the most solemn occasions. Now a highly placed manservant was standing by it, giving it the special strokes which he had been practicing on a smaller gong for days past. The gong boomed, the gate swung open, and into the courtyard wheeled a cavalcade of young monks, lamas, and the chief astrologer. He was an old man, wizened, small, some 80 years of age. Close beside him, almost leg to leg, in fact, rode two lamas whose sole duty it was to make sure that the aged man did not topple off and get trampled underfoot. The horses came to a stop, knowing full well that the end of the journey had come and now they would be well fed. The two lama attendants jumped off their horses and carefully lifted the old astrologer. Then the Lord Rampa came forward and there was the customary exchange of scarves, the customary bowing, and bowing in return. Then the chief astrologer and the Lord Rampa entered the reception room where all the assembled people bowed for a few moments. There was a certain amount of confusion and turmoil. Then the chief astrologer, having politely tasted the proffered buttered tea, motioned to two lamas who carried the notes and charts. The deep-toned gong sounded again. Boom, 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 boom. The far end of the reception room was flung open and the chief astrologer and his two lama attendants walked forward through the door, out into the garden to where a great marquee especially imported from India had been erected. One side of the marquee was open so that the maximum number of people should be able to see and hear what was going on. Inside, the marquee of dais had been erected with rails on three sides, and near the front were four seats. The chief astrologer and his Tilama attendants approached the dais, and then four servants appeared carrying upright poles, or flambeau, because at the distal end there were large flares showing that these men were recognizing that here in this marquee there were the flames of knowledge. Four trumpeters next appeared. They sounded a fanfare. They were to draw attention to Lord and Lady Rampal because their son, the heir to the Lalu estate, was the cause of all the commotion, as one onlooker said. The Lord and Lady slowly mounted the dais, and stood behind the four chairs. From another direction, and with their own retinue, there came two very, very old men from the Lamasery of the State Oracle. These two old men from the Lamasery of Nishung were, after the chief astrologer, the most experienced astrologers in the country. They were collaborators with the chief astrologer. They had gone over the figures and charts and computations, and each of the sheets of the horoscope contained the seals of approval of each of these men. The chief astrologer stood. The others sat. Suddenly there fell a hush upon the assembled company. The chief astrologer gazed out at the throng, and built up suspense by remaining quite silent for some moments, then at a gesture the two lamas moved forward, one to each side of him. The one on the right held the assembled book of the horoscope, the one on the left carefully removed the top wooden plaque, and the chief astrologer read his remarks. People had to strain because, with age, the astrologer had a thin, high voice which to those in the background blended with the birds who chirped in the topmost branches. His opening remarks were the ritual remarks on such occasions. Gods, devils, and men all behave in the same way, he said, so the future can be foretold, but the future is not immutable. The future can, within certain limits, be changed. Thus it is we can forecast only the probabilities, and having forecast the probabilities, predicted the good and the bad, then indeed we must leave the rest to those whose horoscopes we are reading. He stopped and looked about him, and the lama on the left removed the top sheet, leaving the second one exposed. The astrologer took a deep breath and continued, "Here we have the most remarkable horoscope that the three of us have ever computed." He turned and bowed slightly to his two collaborators. Then, clearing his throat, he continued, "This is the horoscope of a young boy just 6 years of age. It is the most difficult horoscope and the hardest life which we have encountered." Lord and Lady Rampal shifted uneasily. Certainly this wasn't turning out as they expected, they weren't at all happy. But, with the training of their caste, they maintained an inscrutable expression. Behind them the cause of all the trouble, the heir to the estate, Lobsang Rampal, felt gloomy indeed. All this waste of time. How many people would have been crossing the river? What was the boatman doing? Were the cats all right? He felt he had to stand there like a stuffed dummy while three ancient, almost fossilized men decided what he would have to do with his life. Surely, he thought, he should have some say in what he was going to do. People had been telling him how wonderful it was to be the heir to such an immense estate, saying what a credit he could be to his parents. Well, he thought he wanted to be a ferryman, he wanted to look after cats somewhere, certainly he didn't want to work. But the astrologer was droning on, and there was a complete silence from the audience. They were indeed enthralled. This boy must go to the medical lamasery at Chakpori, he must do his penance and his homage before he can be permitted to enter, and having entered he must start as the lowest of the low and work his way up. He must learn all the medical arts of Tibet. He must for a time do that which is almost unmentionable. He must work with the disposers of the dead that, in cutting up bodies, he may understand the structure of the human body. Having done this he will return to Chakpori, and study yet again. He will be shown the innermost mysteries of our land, of our belief, and of our science. The old man held out his hand, and an attendant quickly gave him a small silver beaker containing some liquid which he looked at and then swallowed. The attendant carefully took back the silver beaker and refilled it ready for the next demand. The astrologer went on, "Then shall come the time when no longer may he remain in this land of ours, instead he must journey to China to study medicine according to the Western style, for there is a Western school of medicine in Chongqing. At that school of medicine he shall take a fresh name, for let it not be known that the heir to Alus shall be dealing with the bodies. Later he shall learn something which is quite incomprehensible to us at present, it is something which has not yet come about, something which is not yet properly invented. Our experienced brains it seems that he may do something which entails flying through the air, yet which is not the levitation which some of us can do here in Lhasa. So upon this particular aspect I must be obscure, because indeed it is most obscure to the three of us.